All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started here in just a minute. Let me give you a quick heads up. Right now, I think the text must have went out late for some reason. Calls and questions are really light right now. If you have a question, a comment, a topic, or anything you want to talk about, press 1 on your phone right now. I guarantee we'll get to you. And we'll do as right now I don't even have enough to do an hour, so we'll go ahead and get started. I think the calls are going to start coming in, but now would be your chance to get in. The longer you wait, the chances get worse. So I'll keep you updated as we go. Let's go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, we'll talk about it here on the air. And I'll tell you what, we're going to get to the phone calls right away tonight and see how many of your questions we can get to. We're going to start off in New Jersey. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. My question's involving Q4 IFTA tax. I currently use profit gauges, and my carrier is about 2 months behind when it comes to processing my IFTA. For example, December 1st, I just finally got notified I owed X dollars for quarter three. So how does that work when it comes to next year? I won't get my fourth quarter IFTA till roughly March 1st.
Okay. And this is a good question. We get this a lot. When certain transactions happen in 1 year or 1 month and then they don't show up until a later date, the beauty of this is we've set up profit gauges as what's called a cash basis system. And the IRS gives you a couple options. You can either do what's called cash basis accounting, or you can do accrual-based accounting. Accrual is much more complicated. It's a lot harder to understand. It's harder to keep up with. So we designed it as a cash basis system, which means we don't care when a debt may have been incurred or when a revenue item may have been incurred. We only care when they're paid or when they are charged. So even though this is a 2015 tax, you accrued the debt in 2015, it will come out of your settlement. If there is a charge, it will come out of your settlement in 2016, and that's when we show it as being accounted for. That way you don't have to try to keep up with, oh, well, this happened here, but I'm not going to show it till later. It gets very complicated to do accrual-based accounting, so we keep it simple. If you receive money physically in your checking account, you show it on the date that it showed up. If you spend money, we show it on the day you physically spend it. So a settlement, for example, what I recommend on settlements is find a date on your settlements. And all settlements are different. Some of them have multiple dates. Some of them have like the date they were printed. Some of them have the week of date. I don't even care which one you use. Just pick a date on a settlement and be consistent and then enter that settlement with that date. So if you happen to work the last week of December, but your settlement comes on January 3rd, then that money is going to show up as 2016 revenue. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I wanted clarification because my accountant was telling me that we should just go ahead and file an extension. And I'm like, no. But I wanted clarification from you how your software worked. I was pretty sure it was this way. So my accountant's wrong in this deal. So
you can do it either way. It is crazy though for an owner operator to move to accrual accounting and add all that complication. It doesn't change anything. It just makes things a lot more complicated. Now, once in a while. Now, here's the way that trucking companies should be doing it, and most of them do. Even though, like I said, you might work on the last week of the year, but the settlement for that week won't actually hit your account till next year, most trucking companies are pretty good at getting your 1099 correct because they assume that you're going to be on a cash basis. And that settlement, even though you earned it in 2015, since they paid it in 2016, that should go on the 2016 1099. But it's also why we recommend checking your 1099 closely to see if they've got that right.
Okay. That answers all my questions. Thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. You know, we, in our company now, and it's the first time, I've had lots of companies in the past, we've always used cash basis accounting. Our current firm, because of our size and some of the other things going on, they have switched us to accrual based. And it's much more difficult for me to be able to read and understand my business reports, profit and loss statements, things like that. I have to kind of relearn what I'm looking at because it's a very different system. There's really no reason for an owner-operator to do that. We like to keep it nice and simple. Let's go to Illinois. Scott, welcome to the program.
How you doing today, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, I didn't realize until I went to work for these people how much I absolutely hate being leased out to a company. My wife and I have been working to try to get our authority back. I've talked to Kenny Long, and I've talked to other people. These trucking companies can be based out of one place, yet they license their trucks in another state. And since my authority and everything is in New Mexico, it would be about $2,000 a year cheaper for me to license a truck in Illinois and use Maryland's address. I could prove it as a resident because I do get, you know, some of my financial stuff does come there. Question is,
right,
do I have to insure the truck in the same state?
You know, this is, I wish I was going to have a better answer for you, but this is one of the more complicated things. I mean, this is such a crazy industry. We can title a truck in one state, license it in a different state, sometimes insure it out of someplace else, have our IFTA filing out of a totally different state. I mean, it is just crazy, and then you've got all the different states with their different rules. My advice on insurance is always talk to your insurance agent and just be upfront with them and say, look, here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. It's not unusual to have multiple addresses, and you don't even really have to prove Illinois as a residence. If you have an address there, you use it, you can certainly, you know, title a vehicle there, license a vehicle there. But I would just be upfront with your agent and say, here's what we're doing. Our authority's here. We live here. We also have an address here. This is where the vehicle's titled. And get their advice on where you should have the insurance list.
Because my car is insured in New Mexico, and I have one of my vehicles placed in Illinois, so I won't be harassed every time I go down the street with a New Mexico tag. They pull me over looking for guns. And finally, it looks like sometime either this week or the first of next week, I'll finally be able to file my 2014 income tax.
Well, good.
Fortunately,
good. I'm glad to see.
Fortunately, I've got a big-time loss on that one. So, you know, we're looking for a better year.
Well, good. I'm glad to see you getting caught up on the accounting. And like I say, work with your insurance agent. I deal with this all the time. We were on the road for 3 years. We had a business in Florida, a house in Ohio. We were on the road in multiple states. I ended up getting my CDL out of California. And I deal with that now. You know, I got pulled over once here in Oregon, and they wanted to know why I didn't have an Oregon license. And I said, well, I have a residence here, but we also travel. This year we could be on the road 6 months out of the year. So it's just, it is the United States, always that easy. So on insurance, work with your agent, take their advice on where you should be listing that truck for insurance purposes. Let's go to Virginia. Javin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I would like for you to go over my oil analysis with me.
All right, let's take a look. So this is a Series 60. What year?
2002.
Okay, and 132,000 miles, that would be on an in-frame, correct?
Yes, correct.
And 20,000 miles on this sample, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
Because I see the velocity going up. Yes.
Yeah, so this is a really clean sample. And so let's, well, there's the music. Let me get to a break and I'll come back and we'll talk about this right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. If you need anything from us off the air, you can always call our Tribe Care team. They're there to help you out with just about anything. 855-800-FUEL. 855-800-3835. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Hey, we've got a maintenance program that we've started where I give you a maintenance checklist, something that you can work from every quarter to make sure you stay up on top of maintenance. And you can download that checklist free. I'm going to tell you how in just a second, so grab something to write with. And then once you download that form, if you want, we'll send you an email roughly once a week or so with another maintenance tip and the next thing to do in your list. So if you want to be a part of that, it's really simple to sign up. You go to the website, letstruck.com. Look down in the bottom left corner of the homepage. You'll see a sign up there for our newsletter. If you think you may already be signed up, you can fill out the form again. We won't add you twice. We'll double check the email address. And if you're there, we'll just make sure you keep getting the maintenance tips and anything else we send out. So if you're not sure, go ahead and fill it out again. We won't send things to you twice. Letstruck.com, bottom left corner of the homepage. Takes about 10 seconds to sign up. And then we will send you a link to download that maintenance checklist. Very helpful. I'm going to go back to the phones. Let's talk to Minnesota this time. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I was wondering if you have any suggestions on like a accounting 101, just to kind of get some of the terminology and things that you talk about every day? A book or...
Oh, boy, let me think. Not one specifically on accounting. Any accounting books that I've ever come across are incredibly boring and way too complicated. It's kind of an odd situation. We want something really simple because I like to keep accounting simple, and yet there aren't any really good books. Now, we have a couple tutorials in our system, that like videos that show you a lot of this stuff. So that's one place you could start. We have some videos on, you know, reading your financial reports that we keep pretty simple. You know, the best book I could probably recommend, and it's not specifically about accounting, but it's got some good accounting, real basic accounting information in it, and it's really just a good business book as well. It's titled Personal MBA, and I just drew a total blank on the author. But if you look up Personal MBA, and it is available on Audible as a audio book, and it's just a really good basic business book, and it will talk some about accounting and reading financial reports and terms and things like that.
Okay. Well, that's the only question I had for you today, Kevin. So thank you very much.
Got it. You're welcome. And I am going to be putting together some more tutorials on accounting. We have some in our system. And again, you can find them at letstruck.com. So I'm going to go back to Virginia. I was talking with Javin before the break about an oil sample. Javin, you still with me?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So let's go through this. Fuel dilution is non-existent. Soot is at 0.4, which is excellent. There's nothing in this. A great base. The oil's holding up really well. No oxidation, no nitration, no coolant, and wear metals are extremely low. So this is a really, really clean sample. Now, the odd thing is the viscosity is a little higher than we would like to see, but there doesn't seem to be any apparent reason why. Now, normally, if we see viscosity start climbing, it's either because we have a lot of soot, which you don't, not at all. Coolant getting into the oil could cause viscosity to go up. We don't have any indication of coolant. So this might just be one of those oddball readings. Every now and then, now you're using a 5W30 Rotella. Have you added anything like Lucas or used a different makeup oil at any time?
No.
Okay. Then, because sometimes Lucas would obviously make the viscosity go up, but sometimes somebody will grab a different oil.
It's full of synthetic T6 from Walmart now. On the gallon of jug, it's a 5W40. I don't know why they keep putting 5W30. I think that's the call.
Oh. Well, then that explains this. Because if they thought this was a 5W40, then they wouldn't flag this viscosity as a level 2. It would be absolutely perfect. If this is a 40 weight oil, then it's just a paperwork error and your viscosity is perfect. This sample is really a 0.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I keep putting 5W40 on there, but I don't know why they keep putting 5W30. So.
Okay, and that's all it is. They think that if this is a 30-weight oil, the viscosity should be in the 12 range, but a 40-weight,
okay,
it should be exactly where you are. 13.6 is perfect, so this is a really good-looking sample.
Oh, okay, great, excellent. Thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's, I've got a... before I do that, let me get to a phone call. Let me go to Virginia. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good. What's on your mind today?
I wanted to see if you could take a look at my business report. I pretty much got everything caught up on it except for the next couple of weeks left in December.
Okay.
And wanted to kind of pick your brain on directions for this coming year.
Got it. So tell me a little bit about your operation.
I'm leased on to a major carrier. Been out on my own now for about a year and a half. So my first 6 months was in 2014, the end of 2014. So this is my first full year. First 6 months, I got to really see where I needed to cut and nip as far as fuel and maintenance. And this year, I did a lot of modifications, spent a lot of money on modifications and also on training, education. Took a course in brokerage, and my wife and I are both going to the CMC, so I paid for that and a couple other things. So this coming year is definitely a year that I'm looking to increase the profit and see exactly what I can do. But I'm also, after January, looking at changing over to Landstar. So that's going to make a big cut.
Got it. Okay, and that makes a lot of sense. So if we go through this, revenue was $1.43 a mile, all miles. And we're going to come back to that. So your fixed costs are about 25 cents a mile, nothing horrendous there. Fuel was at 37, a little high given fuel prices this year. We see people down actually in the 20s, which is pretty rare. So reasonably, we could probably shave 7 cents off that if fuel prices hold where they are. So there's about 7 cents more to be made there. Maintenance was at 18. You talked a lot about upgrades. Perfectly fine. In fact, that's a good thing. We could expect, you know, we could probably shave 8 cents off there. So there's another 15 cents in the big areas that we could get right now. $1.43, you know, all miles, nothing to get too excited about, but it's pretty common being on with the big carrier. And you still managed to put 50 cents a mile to the bottom line. We just identified about 15 cents more we could make. That would take you to 65, which would be excellent. Now, there's another big change here, though. You go to Landstar, we could turn that $1.43 into $1.65 with today's rates. It's not that difficult. So now, between, you know, where you're heading, getting your expenses under control and what we could expect, and the change to Landstar, this 50 cents a mile could become 80 cents a mile. Huge difference. So you've had a great first year. These are respectable numbers right here, but you've also done a lot of things to set yourself up for even better numbers. So I think 2016 is going to be a great year for you.
Good, good. One of the biggest questions I was going to ask is in my plan right now, because I'm a year and a half in and I knew this year was going to be a making year or whatever, next year I plan on setting aside a wage, actually doing wages. Having my wife, she's a bookkeeper in accounting and all, and she's going to be actually cutting a check, which I've already done all my numbers and a spreadsheet to kind of tell me where I'm going to be as far as a cent per mile and all that. I just wanted to make sure in talking with you that, you know, is it a good possibility to have probably, I'm an LLC, so filing as an S-corp next year in order to gain benefits or not?
Okay, so hold that thought. We'll come back to that right after the break, and we'll talk about that. Good question. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to the phones. I was talking with John in Virginia. So, John, we've got a little bit of a challenge here. Just because of timing, and we have a certain amount of time to make that election to move to an S-Corp, roughly about 3 months at the beginning of the year. There's some exceptions, but it's also better to make the election at the beginning of the year so that it really simplifies our accounting. It can be quite a bit more complicated to operate part of the year as a sole proprietor or an LLC taxed as a sole proprietor, then move to an S-Corp. If I had to predict, based on what you've done this year, the changes you're making next year, there's a really good chance that in 2016, you will want to be an S-Corp. Sometimes I tell people, wait till we have that 1 year where you were for sure that you needed it. So, if you were to go ahead and do the S-Corp, and like I say, you have a couple months here at the beginning of the year, the odds are it's going to make sense. The odds are you're going to see the advantage. So just based on what you're telling me, the other thing I like, you guys are right on top of your numbers. Your wife's part of this. She gets it. So you're one of those cases where I could say we could jump the gun a little bit, anticipate what's going to happen in 2016, and go ahead and move to the S-Corp.
Okay. All right. That sounds great. That's kind of where I was headed anyways. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I was on the right avenue. I appreciate all you do, and, you guys have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we're looking forward to the future.
Fantastic. Can't wait to see you at the CMC. You're going to absolutely love that. So, again, we might be jumping the gun a little bit, but looking at how well you did in your first year, the way you're planning, the way you're tracking your numbers, you're getting more education, you're coming to the CMC, it's just about guaranteed that this is going to work for you and the S-Corp will be to your advantage. So, congratulations on doing the hard work, planning, working through this. It's really paying off. Let's go to New York. Ken, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kev. A little bit of an update on my fuel numbers. I have, in the last 65,000 miles, cost per mile is about 27 cents.
Excellent.
Really working hard. I feel that I can make that better, but because back in 2001, I was getting better than 7 miles to the gallon with this same truck, and it just seems like you get an overhead run, and I've talked briefly about this before, and they kind of set the ECM to meet
the
government, But anyways, I'm struggling through that, and it's at 27 cents right now. Go ahead.
I was going to say 27 cents is excellent. We always want to improve it. And the other thing, and you kind of alluded to this, and I dealt with this for years, as much as I know about fuel economy, it's not a one-time thing, or it's not, oh, look, I got to 8.5 miles to the gallon, I'm done for life. It is a never-ending challenge. I mean, there's always something changing. You know, you get where you want, something breaks, or your fuel mileage drops, you can't even figure out why. So it's nonstop. It's something you're always working on and always addressing. It's something you get better at over time, but it's never something you can just ignore.
You got it there, buddy. The main reason for my phone call was a tax question, and I don't even know how to start. It's very in-depth. I'm going to try to hit the high points and see what you have to say. 2013, I was parked, got in an accident while I was parked, put me out of business for a year and a half with the trucking. The farming obviously suffered terribly because the trucking was down for that year and a half.
Right.
As you can imagine.
Yeah.
Last tax year for the farm, -61,000. Hurt us really bad.
Okay.
Yeah, I really am looking forward to possibly another bad tax year here. But we're on the road to recovery, okay? But
okay.
Since 2013, I don't see our breeding program getting any better in the short term. So we've decided to kind of I just want to stick to the trucking and just focus on our homegrown beef and pork and chicken and all that stuff to keep our ketogenic diet flying high. So we're
okay.
going to cut back on that breeding program. And here's my big question. When you spend all of these years building a business and it starts to go and you get a devastation like this, like an accident, and it set us back 2.5, almost working on 3 years. How does that work with the government if we just kind of shut down that part of our business when we were trying to build a business, we were having sales, but the sales weren't putting us in a profit situation yet? And I just don't want to do something and have ramifications as far as the government's concerned.
Got it. Okay, and I kind of know where you're going with this. And what I can tell you is you don't need to worry about this. There are a lot of myths that fly around that, like, you have to make a profit within 5 years. None of those things
right.
are true. I don't even know where those things come from. For example, if you think about the Internet boom that started in the late 90s, early 2000s, there are internet companies that went 10 years, huge companies, went 10 years, never showed a profit. There is no time limit on when you have to start making a profit in order to have it be considered a business. What the IRS looking at is, are you really attempting to run a business? Now, there are some things that you've got to be careful of because they are clearly more like hobbies than businesses. And the ones that the IRS will really clamp down on are the ones that are very recreational in nature. Like, there are some people who truly run a business at being a fishing guide. They go to work every day, they charge people, they advertise, they have good accounting systems in place, and they are truly working to make that a profitable business. Now, if they do that for 3 or 4 or 10 years, but they don't show a profit and they have some other source of income, maybe the spouse works, then that is a business. On the other hand, if they have a full-time job and they do this a couple times a month, and maybe they print up some business cards, or, you know, the odds are the IRS is going to look at that as a hobby, not a business. So
right.
it doesn't have anything to do with profit. It has everything to do with the amount of work and time you put in, your intentions, all kinds of other things. And here's the way this works. You can take tax deductions for a hobby. So let's say that you are one of these guys that you do you're a fishing guide a couple times a month when you have time. And you buy a boat and you buy equipment and all that stuff. And then you charge people. And let's say you only book 3 gigs this month. Well, if you had revenue that came in, you can use your expenses to offset that revenue down to zero. But you can't take a loss on a hobby. You could show zero, even if you had money coming in. If you have more expenses than money, you can take your revenue to zero so that you pay no tax. You just can't take it into a loss and then use that loss to offset other income. But if it's truly a business and it has a loss, even if it has a loss year after year after year, you can use that loss to offset other income. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, that's very good. Sounds like
well, hold that thought. Let me get to a break. We'll come back. That's a complicated kind of distinction, so I want to make sure we get that clear. We'll be right back. We'll talk more about that. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. All right, a quick heads up. We're heading into the fourth segment of the first hour. I'm going to say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. Don't hang up. We're going to come back and do another hour, and we have lots of questions on hold right now. So I'll keep you updated. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to go back to New York. I was talking with Ken. So, Ken, you know, you could continue. I mean, you could shut down or just not do a lot with this business right now. If you still have expenses, you could even say, look, you know, we're going to call this a hobby for a little while. So for a while, we will continue to deduct expenses, but only to offset income. We're not going to try to claim a loss. Or you could say, hey, you know what? It's a business. We may slow down this year. We still consider it a business. We're going to take all of our expenses and take it into a loss. It's really up to you.
Okay, yeah. You know, the people that have been doing our taxes for years now, he kind of put the scare tactic out there that, you know, once you hit that 7-year mark, you're really going to have to be cautious. Well, you know, we didn't expect a bad economy. You know, when the economy tanks, purchases of boats, motorhomes, any kind of products that are luxury products, which is basically what we breed, it's just a rare breed. And to have a devastating accident that basically brings no income for a year and a half. And so it's going to be a long struggle to get back. But, you know, I didn't want to not take the time to ask this question because I don't need another thing on my plate right now. I just need to focus forward, keep working with Tim about profit gauges, get signed up for the CMC, and get my butt back on track is what I want to focus on, and I don't need these issues haunting me every day, and this was a big one. So thank you. That's kind of the question that I wanted, or the answer that I wanted to that question. It's not a hobby. We've spent 11 years building it. We have some of the highest percentage bloodlines on the face of the earth. When you're only talking 20,000 head, that's a lot of hard work. And we live it 360. And when you live something 365 days a year, and you're getting up at 5 a.m. and not going to bed till midnight, it's hardly a hobby. But it's a business to our heart. But if it's the right thing, then we just need to kind of sell off stock and just tank the idea. Which is a shame, you know?
Right. No, I agree. And again, I understand your accountant. Most accountants and tax preparers are very conservative. You never know what the IRS is going to do, so they try to give sometimes worst-case scenario just so you know. But I tend to be a little more aggressive. If you're working that hard at a business, I don't care how many years it loses money, it's still a business.
Right. Well, We're on the road to recovery here, and I just want to make good choices. So,
let me give you another example, just so you realize. I had a couple of my clients over the years that actually started a tree farm. Well, imagine how long it takes to show a profit. You have to wait for the trees to grow. But you have expenses every single year. You had to buy the land. You had to plant the trees. You have to fertilize. You have labor. And that could go on for 15 years or more, depending on the species of tree. So, again, there's that, five-year rule we hear all the time. It's just not true. The time doesn't matter. It's really the effort, and is it truly a business, or is it a hobby that you're attempting to make a business? But either way, we get to deduct expenses. It just comes down to, if it's a hobby, you can only go to zero. If it's a true business, you can take a loss and use it to offset other income.
So maybe I need to try to hang in here, get switched over as I'm in the process of working with Kim. Get switched over, keep working hard, and try to bring this all together than to throw all those years of hard work away, because that's an exact example. You breed a rare breed of horse, and then you take 2.5 to 3 years off, and you don't breed nothing, and you sell some of your product. It's just like not restocking your shelves. So our shelves are no longer stocked.
So here's what I would recommend.
Okay.
Yeah, here's what I would recommend. Make your decision based on the real world and what is happening every day and what you want to do with this business, and ignore the IRS.
Okay. Great. Exactly what I was hoping to hear. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. And, good luck with that. And, don't abandon it because you're worried about what the IRS is going to say about this. If you want to put the business on hold for a little while, if you want to make it a hobby for now, you don't have to give it up. Make your decisions based on everything except the IRS. We can deal with them. Let's go to Minnesota. Dean, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Shut this down here.
All right.
I was looking at, I was unloading hog feed. I was looking at the ketogenic diet. I guess I've been looking at it for a long time, but my body's starting to tell me I need to do something. My legs are like leg cramps without, just before you're going to get a leg cramp. My legs are like that in the last 6 months here. Plus, I can't seem to lose any weight. But I was looking at the ketogenic diet and trying to figure out how to really get started on it.
Okay. So, the leg cramps, muscle cramps, that's a pretty clear sign of a mineral deficiency or a mineral imbalance. It can happen on any diet. It actually tends to occur more on a ketogenic diet in the beginning, because of the water loss that's going to happen, and you're actually going to lose some of those minerals. So there's three minerals to focus on for leg cramps or muscle cramps, and I would focus on them whether you start the ketogenic diet or not. And they're sodium, potassium, and magnesium. Get those three in balance, and the cramps will go away. So, but to jump to the next part, which is how do you get started on the ketogenic diet, the first thing you decide is, do you want to ease into it, or do you want to just, bite the bullet, go cold turkey, get it over with as quick as possible? Some people suffer symptoms that they refer to as the keto flu. Some people don't. I've seen people go 100% cold turkey, do it in a couple days, never have any symptoms at all. I've seen other people where the first week they just don't feel all that great. None of it is horrible. And all of it is easy to get through or minimize by doing a couple things. As far as starting it, what do you do? You just start. I mean, you just switch the way you eat. Now, it seems pretty drastic on the surface, but the quicker you get into ketosis, the quicker you're going to see the results. So it really, again, just depends on how you want to do this. The basics of this is you start looking at your meals or any time you eat, and the focus really needs to be on fat. Most of your calories when you're in ketosis have to come from fat. Protein needs to be minimized, and carbohydrates need to be pretty severely restricted, especially in the beginning. So one of the ways we could do this is, okay, how many carbohydrates and how much protein? So if we start with carbohydrates, if you want to make sure that you are going to get into ketosis, you need to consume less than 20 net grams of carbs a day. So one of the things you have to start doing is looking at how many carbs are in a food. When I say net carbs, the way we come to net carbs is you look at total carbs, subtract out fiber, and then that's your net carbs. You're going to be really, really limited in order to stay under 20. Now, that 20 number is only for a couple weeks. After that, we'll start to slowly increase the carbs until you get to the point, and you got to kind of work through this and feel it out. So under 20 grams of carbs to get started, that's net carbs, and under 80 grams of protein. That's not a lot. That's not a lot of carbs. It's not a lot of protein. So what happens now is once you hit those two numbers, you eat the rest of your calories in fat, and you eat it until you're satisfied. We don't want to be hungry. And if you do this right, you won't be hungry ever. If you're hungry, you eat. As long as you keep your two numbers down, your carbs and your protein, you can eat the rest in fat, and your hunger will normalize, and you won't overeat. I mean, I've done this with a lot of people. So that's a really good way to get started. The other thing I would highly recommend, go listen to the book Keto Clarity. That'll give you step-by-step. It'll give you menus, all kinds of things. The music's playing. I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you back here next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work. Then master the journey. I'm Kev Gruff. All right, we're going to start a second hour. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it. We'll tackle it here on this show. All you have to do is call us and ask your question. I'm going to get to those questions in just a little bit. One of our big topics this year has been health. I like the way that it's kind of settling down and just becoming a part of the show. For a while there, it was almost taking over. But I say this all the time. I can open the show, and I do many times with a topic, but ultimately this show is about you. It's about the callers and what they want to talk about. So for a while, we had a lot of health questions. That's fine. Now it's just kind of settling down and becoming part of the show, and we do an hour or two each week just about health because we do have so many questions. But it's definitely something I'm continuing to work on. I'm in a really intensive nutritional therapy program right now, finished up the first semester. I have two more. It is I'm really excited about what I'm learning. This is an amazing program. I would highly recommend that if you want to be healthier, that you look up and find a nutritional therapy practitioner in your area, NTP. That's the program I'm going through right now. I more than likely will not go into a real practice when I'm done. I'll just use the knowledge here to help my listeners. I may see some clients here and there, but not a lot. But you can go to the nutritional therapy website, nutritionaltherapy.com, and in the menu item there, you'll see a list of providers. So you can look them up by location. You can find one near you. It's really an amazing process that they go through. Now, one of the things that I have struggled with over the years when it comes to fitness and nutrition and health are supplements. I'm not a big fan. I kind of look at supplements the way I look at oil and fuel additives. I just don't see the need most of the time. Now, I've said that if we identify a problem, let's talk about oil and fuel additives. If we identify a problem and we can get a product to address that specific problem, I recommend that. I just don't recommend blanket use of additives because you waste more money. So let's say that we identify that the injectors have some buildup and we run an injector cleaner. Great idea, works. We don't want to put that stuff in all the time. If I identify that we have some fuel dilution in the oil and it's going to take us a while to troubleshoot it, you'll hear me say, dump some Lucas in. That'll protect us. That is a targeted use of additives because we've identified a problem and we know this additive will solve that problem. The training that I'm getting through NTP has allowed me to see that we can do the same thing in the body. Now, you could walk into a health food store and they'll recommend everything on the shelf. I just don't believe in that. I certainly don't believe in multivitamins. They are worthless. But what I'm seeing now, part of the NTP program, is that we do a functional evaluation. We test all the important systems in your body, the adrenal glands, the thyroid function, muscle endurance, blood sugar control, digestion. We test all these things and we can identify a specific problem and then we can use a targeted supplement to address that problem. So you will hear me talking a little bit more about some very specific targeted supplements to solve a problem we've identified. And I like that. I knew there was something to this. I just didn't like the way most people take supplements. Like I say, there's a bazillion supplements on the market, and they all make wild claims. And yet my experience over the years is that they just don't do a whole lot. But now I know why. You can't take the shotgun approach. You identify a problem, find the right supplement, use the right supplement, test to make sure that it's doing some good. And then eventually, we should be able to get off of that supplement. Supplements shouldn't be something we have to take our whole life. They should be something that we can make up in our diet. Now, occasionally, if we find that just because of your diet and restrictions or being out on the road, we know that's a challenge, there may be a supplement that I would say, you know what, this just needs to be something you take until we could change the diet, if that ever happens. And if not, you add this specific targeted supplement. So much more to talk about. We're going to get to some phone calls, though. Let's start off in South Carolina. Marty, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. This is Marty. I just wanted
What's on your mind today?
Calling. I just wanted to say thanks for the heads up on the Keto Clarity book.
Did you listen to that one?
Yes, sir. Yeah, that was awesome. I was all fired up not to do it. I looked up everything on the internet. I heard you kept talking about it on your show, and I'm like, everything was negative that I looked up. And when you mentioned the book, I said, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt, because you had other people calling in how well it does. And I just want that. The amount of information in that book is just unbelievable.
And the other thing is that there's a lot of contributing authors to that book. You know that because you've listened to it. It's like 15 doctors, researchers, scientists, nutritionists. So this isn't just, you know, one guy who decided to write a blog. There's some heavy-duty research behind this, some people with real credentials. The thing you have to remember is that a natural diet, whether it's a primal diet, a paleo diet, just a good whole food diet, or ketogenic, we are learning, and we've actually known this, but it's becoming much more known now, that these are powerful things. That if we get back to eating a whole food diet, I'll give you the phrase that we use in the NTP program, a properly prepared, nutrient-dense, whole food diet, which is about the opposite of the standard American diet, if we get back to that kind of eating, it solves a lot of medical problems. Now, there are a lot of groups who would hate to see that happen because they make a lot of money off of all of our sicknesses. So you will find a lot of opposition to this, but if you dig, you can also find a lot of support and a lot of research that backs this up, and this book really is one of the best to get started.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Me and my family have Lyme disease, so we're already doing the no sugar and gluten free. So I'm already halfway there in most of the product, you know, with most of the things. So it's not going to be hard for me to start on it. Now you helped me today by listening to you on the 80 grams of protein, 20 grams of carbs, and breaking that down. That's simple. And Jimmy has that in his book. He has a 21-day startup thing. That's why I say the book is just awesome. He gives you all the recipes and everything to start with, and he even has his own cookbook out, you know.
Oh, exactly. And you know, I only have so much time here on the air, so I can give you – like, I could give you that guideline, which does make it pretty simple. If you count your – and you don't have to count forever either. You'll figure out in a week or two – you'll know what you can eat. You'll know what 80 grams of or 80 grams of protein looks like and 20 grams of carbs. And then after that, if you're hungry, you eat fat. So it is kind of simple. But the book, I mean, really lays it out for you. Like you say, if you want to follow his 21-day program, I guarantee you'll go right into ketosis. You'll get all the benefits. And it really is a great resource for getting started.
Yes, it is. Just to change gears, and just thank you so much for mentioning that, because I was almost – I'd looked at everything like I told you. I was already convinced I was not going to do it because everything on the internet, WebMD and all that stuff, which he mentions in the book, it's weird that I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, hold that thought. I agree. But this is one of those cases, and I'm not a conspiracy nut. This isn't a conspiracy. It's pretty obvious. There's a lot of money in keeping Americans and the whole world unhealthy. There's a lot of money in selling unhealthy food. There's a lot of money in selling medical care and drugs to cover up all the problems that they created with the bad food. So there is a lot of money that doesn't want to see a good whole food diet become popular. The ketogenic diet solves even more problems quicker. So you are going to find a lot of opposition to it. But if you look, you can find a lot of support and a lot of evidence that it works. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Ruff. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website, letstruck.com. I'm going to go back to the phones. I was talking with Marty. Marty, go ahead. Marty, are you there?
Yes, sir. Are you still there?
I am. Go
you
ahead.
There? Okay. Yeah, I just I wanted to say one other little thing about you had mentioned, you know, how you could, sometimes you have trucks, you had your trucks under warranty, and you just paid the money. Well, I had something happen last about 2 weeks ago. Transmission put in by Triple that had the micro blue with it, and I had just a regular mechanic put the transmission in. Nothing complicated about it, I thought, but it had to be pulled out again. And so they educated me and told me how much there there's involved in installing a transmission, and which I didn't think that much was involved. And I just took your advice, and I took it to another Eaton certified dealer, and I just paid it because I didn't want it to be wrong again.
Yeah, and that was the problem I faced with, you know, the OEM, specifically Volvo was my big issue. We had a horrible Volvo dealer in Orlando, and actually bad Volvo dealers are not uncommon. I've dealt with several of them, and I just got to the point where when you look at it logically, our goal is to spend the least amount of money we can to get the results we want. And you could say, well, the warranty's free. We have to look at the overall cost. I would take it over for warranty. A job that should take 2 hours would sit in their shop for 2 days because they didn't want to get to it. They do all their other work first. So now I've lost 2 days of revenue, or I've spent 2 days of truck rental. Then it would come out and it wouldn't be right. And I'd have to go back and do it again. And yes, they would fix it free, but when is free not free? It's not free if it's costing me money. And I had to go rent trucks again and all the time. And so I got to the point where most of my warranty work, I would just pay my shop to do it because it would get done right. It would get done quicker. And my overall cost was lower. And that's the whole point.
Right. Well, I was trying to save a buck. You know, I thought $85 an hour versus $150, you know. And I thought, well,
right.
And now look where it got me. Look where it got me, you know.
Yeah, and we've all done that. I've done it many, many times. I'm sure I'll do it again. It's part of growing in business. Now, you know, one of the things I've often said, though, I learn far more from my mistakes than I do from doing things right. Sometimes we just get lucky and do something right. We don't even know why it's right. But when we make a mistake, and the bigger the mistake, the more it costs us, the more likely it is we're going to learn something from it. So I actually, as crazy as this sounds, I set out to make a lot of mistakes really quick because the quicker I can make the mistakes, the quicker I'll learn what to do right.
I hear you. Well, I just want to thank you for everything you do. You help me with my fuel mileage, all the things that you do. I just appreciate everything you do, and I hope you have a good Christmas, you and Lisa.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I love doing what I do, and I love seeing people benefit from it. So, Merry Christmas. Thank you for the compliments. Let's head off to Minnesota. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Been listening to your show for a while, and I got on the ketogenic diet for a little bit there, kind of fell off the bandwagon, and looking to start that up again here after the holidays. And just had a question on protein consumption. I know you're supposed to stay under 80 grams of protein per day, especially when you're starting out. But is there a number that's too low for, you'd actually be doing just as much harm by not eating enough protein?
Yes. And let's talk about the macronutrients in general. Macronutrients refer to three things. There's actually more, but one macronutrient is water, so we don't talk a whole lot about that. Just drink enough to be hydrated. So the macronutrients come down to protein, fat, carbohydrates. And of those three, only two of them are essential. You have to have protein. You have to have fat. You can't live without those two. Carbohydrates are not required to sustain life. You could, if it were possible, and it's almost impossible, you could be healthy on zero carbohydrates. We do need some fiber, and foods that have fiber tend to have carbohydrates. So we do add some into the diet. Lots of foods that have carbohydrates are very healthy. Mostly vegetables is what we're talking about. But carbohydrates are not a requirement. The other two are. So we could go as low as we want on carbohydrates and then tweak that number later on. But protein, if we go too low on protein, what will happen is what's called muscle wasting. So your body needs protein. If you don't consume it, if you don't eat it, your body will start pulling protein from wherever it can find it, primarily your muscles, and you will see muscle wasting or muscle shrinkage. If you can't get enough protein, then the basic building processes are going to suffer and you're going to have disease. So we do need to get enough. The good news is it's not very hard to get enough. In fact, the challenge is not getting too much. I mean, a couple of eggs have a lot of protein. A little bit of cheese has a lot of bit of protein. 6 ounces of beef has a lot of protein. Nuts have protein. So if you're eating the ketogenic foods, the odds are you're going to have to be careful not to get too much. It's really difficult not to get enough. Getting enough fat is a challenge sometimes. Getting enough protein is usually not hard at all. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I found a recipe because I love chili. I'm a chili guy, and it's kind of hard to find a decent recipe without beans or something that, you know, all the stuff we're not supposed to have. And I found a really great paleo keto chili, and it's moderate on protein. I think it's got about 20 grams of protein. It's a little high on carbs for if you're just starting out. I counted up 12 and a half grams of carbs, and I think I kind of scared myself away a little bit with a little bit of a higher content in carbs. And with such a high fat content in that chili, I was filling up. So I think I'm not getting enough, you know, enough protein in, because I, you know, maybe eat a couple pieces of bacon and a couple eggs in the morning for breakfast, and then I'd be fine till the evening, and then I'd eat that little bit of chili there, and I'd be full the rest of the night, and that would be about it, all I'd eat all day. So I was thinking maybe I was getting around 40 grams of protein only for the day, and maybe I was kind of going backwards in reverse.
You know, how active are you? Because that's another factor here. If somebody is really physically active, heavy weightlifting, high-intensity training, then we're going to need a little more protein. But honestly, 40 grams a day for somebody who isn't really active and is just getting started ketogenic, 40 grams a day isn't going to hurt. There's probably going to be days where you get more than that. You know, like I say, it's not hard. You'd be surprised where some protein might be sneaking in and you're really not even paying attention. A couple handfuls of nuts, a little bit of bacon, some eggs, some cheese. If you're eating any dairy, it has protein. Most meat has way more protein than what we think. And we've kind of been brainwashed that we need all this protein. People take protein shakes and protein supplements and protein bars, and we're really overdoing the protein. And I'll tell you again, the reason why, it comes back to the money. It's easy to sell protein powders and shakes and drinks and bars. There's money in it. There isn't a lot of money in telling somebody, hey, you know, if you eat a good whole food diet, you're going to get plenty of protein without all that stuff.
Right, exactly. And I used to be the ones that would buy the protein shakes and the pre-workout. I mean, right now I'm not very active. I've kind of, but I'm looking to get back into it here also. But, yeah, I used to spend, you know, $70-$80 on a tub of protein. And, you know, you got your pre-workouts. I'd spend $150-$200 a month in all the supplements and all that kind of stuff. And, boy, how much money I just threw out the window.
Me too. Me too. I've been there. I've been through it all, and I like where I am now. Like I said earlier, targeted supplementation makes sense. Protein is not one of the things we need to supplement. I'll give you a great idea for a snack. Good, and we always want to find the highest quality food we can. If I have to buy it at the store, I will. But beef jerky is like crazy high in protein. And if you buy some of the good, you know, paleo bars, meat bars or beef jerky, crazy amounts of protein in a small snack. So, like I say, protein is one of the easier things to get, and it's actually much easier to overdo protein than underdo it. Very, very few people, unless you're a vegetarian. But if you're a meat eater and you're eating ketogenic, you got to watch getting too much. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rothenberg. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. We're going to head off this time to New York. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Well, I talked to you a month or two ago about I bought a 2003 Volvo with a pre-EGR ISX. And when I went and picked it up finally, I noticed that it has 24/5 tires, wheels.
Okay.
Should I look to switch those down to 22/5s? Will it do me any good? Will it do me bad?
What gear ratio?
I don't remember what gear ratio the truck is, and I don't have the information with me.
Okay. 10-speed or 13?
It's a 10-speed. It's a 3-pedal auto shift 10-speed.
Okay. So if it were a 13-speed, I'd be able to answer the question without knowing the gear ratio. With a 10-speed,
okay,
it's a little trickier, but let me ask you another question. Are you going to run fairly slow speeds?
Fuel mileage-wise, I would always be looking. I'm thinking probably between 60, maybe, 62 or so. But if I have to, I found my information. It says it's got 355 rears.
Okay, perfect. Then, yes, change to 22.5s. There's a couple ways to go about this. Switching rims is usually pretty cheap. 22.5 rims are everywhere, so it's not a big deal. But it's also a time you might think about going to wide singles since you're buying rims anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Spend a little more, get the wide single rims, make that switch. But 22.5s are going to improve both fuel economy and performance for you on this truck.
Okay. Okay. Well, good. Because right now, and it's got recaps on the drives. On the drives, and I just but I'll probably they're really aggressive, pretty aggressive treads. So I'm going to probably run those through the winter while I make some money, and then look to make a switch in the spring.
Got it. Okay, and that
so,
makes sense.
But yeah,
the sooner the better.
If
you have an aggressive retread, you're probably looking at a rolling resistance of 140 or higher, which means
right,
switching to wide singles on the drive would mean like a 6 or 7 tenths of a mile per gallon improvement. It's going to be big. So,
wow.
Definitely,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's people do not realize. So if we can look up rolling resistance, and on those retreads you probably can't. I'm going to guess that they are 150. For every 10 points, for every 10 points we can lower rolling resistance, we'll pick up a tenth of a mile per gallon. You're at 150 now, if I had to guess. We can go all the way to 90 with the wide single.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's a solid six tenths. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And then would I get additional help, you know, additional benefit from the 22.5 as well?
Yes. Yeah, you're getting two benefits.
Okay.
One, because we could list it out, it's even bigger. When we make the rim smaller and lighter, that's a benefit because it's less what they call unsprung weight. We make the sidewall shorter, which lowers rolling resistance. We go to wide singles, which lowers rolling resistance. So, plus we actually get a better RPM out of this. By changing that tire, we're actually changing the gearing. So, half mile per gallon is like a slam dunk, and I would expect 6 or 7 tenths, actually.
Okay. And then when I do that, I would have to reprogram the ECM? Because will it alter my speedometer and everything?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it'll screw up the speedometer, and you will go in, and it's a simple fix. Takes about 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's what I figured. It was just a programming thing. So.
Right.
Okay. Well, that is perfect. That's what I was wanting to know. I didn't know. I had a guy tell me, no, the 24.5 would get me better mileage because it turns slower, turns less.
Yeah, that's a misnomer. That's a myth. It's just not true. RPM is only one function of fuel economy, and many times we're already running the engine at too low of an RPM, and by bringing it up, we can actually improve fuel economy. But the more important factor is the unsprung weight and the rolling resistance, and the smaller tire always wins. Yeah.
Okay. Beautiful. Well, that was it for me.
All right. Thanks for the call. Good stuff. Let's go to Ohio. Doug, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Kevin. Fair tax yesterday.
Absolutely. What's on your mind today?
Got a question. I know that you can only answer in generalities regarding IRP registration and insurance requirements. I'm currently a lease purchase operator for a small carrier out of New York, and I've got 3 payments left on the truck. Then it's mine.
Well, congratulations.
Now, I live in Kentucky. I want to ultimately base plate the truck in Kentucky so that I have complete control over the truck, which is only fair and logical. The carrier I'm leased to is based in New York. What insurance, you know, again, generally speaking, do I have to personally carry so that I can base plate the truck in my name rather than having the carrier base plate the truck in their domicile state?
Let's see. So, there really is no clear answer to this. They're probably going to give you a better answer, but you shouldn't have to change anything. You already have your insurance through the carrier, correct?
Correct.
Now,
so basically,
is there any
I would have to talk to the state department and have them get a Kentucky ID card for me.
You would start with the carrier because that's where you could run into some restrictions. If we're doing all this on our own, then we can go kind of do whatever we want. But if you want to keep your insurance through the carrier, and there's nothing wrong with that, if it's a good price, just keep it there. It's easy. But all you're really looking to do is get a different base plate. That's not a problem at all. You should just be able to go get a different base plate, and everything else should stay the same.
Now, if I base plate the truck myself in my domicile state, do I also have to then get my own IFTA account?
No. No, that's optional. You could get your own IFTA account, but you don't have to. You can have a base plate in one state and an IFTA account in another. You can title a truck in one state, displayed it in a different state, and have your IFTTTA account somewhere else.
Okay, that clarifies it somewhat for me. And the reason I'm looking to do that is ultimately, at some point during 2016, I want to get that carrier's DOT number off of the door of the truck and put my own DOT number on the truck. I'm already cultivating relationships with potential shippers and receivers.
Excellent, excellent. And this is a good start, then.
All righty, that's all I've got for you, and Merry Christmas to you, Lisa, and the whole Let's Truck team.
Merry Christmas. Thanks for that. Let's see. I'm going to jump to another call here. Let's go to Houston. John, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin.
What's on your mind today?
I got a couple of questions for you. We got a 99 Volvo 770 with a 264-inch wheelbase. We're just curious, if we shorten the frame, will it take the weight off the steers? We brought the tandems closer.
No, it's more than likely going to add weight to the steers. The closer we move the tandems to the steers, the more weight we're going to transfer up there. The longer you stretch out the frame, the more you can isolate that weight on the tandems and not transfer as much to the steers.
I see. Yeah, this is a really heavy truck, and we're having problems with the steers. And yeah, we're usually running about 100 gallons just to keep the weight off the steers. And that's with the 17,000 in the box. It's always, it says it's 22,983.
Yeah, one of your options, and this gets a little dicey. Let me address it when we come back. We'll talk about it. Stick around. We'll be right back with more stuff. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with John in Houston. So, John, we're allowed to have potentially up to 20,000 pounds on that steer axle. Now, it's a little difficult to get to 20,000, but we could certainly increase the capacity by going to a different tire. Now, every component in the front end has to be rated for the higher weight. Now, I'm not sure what axle rating you have. A lot of times they're just not looking at that. A lot of times the scales will only look at the tire weight rating, and if you're okay, then they'll let it go.
Okay. But, our tire rating, 12349, it's almost pretty much the same as the axle.
Yeah. So it's pretty difficult once you've got a heavy truck to get the weight off that steer axle. You can look at potentially moving the fuel tanks back on the frame if you have room. That's one of the possibilities. But it's pretty difficult. You can play around with different fifth wheel settings, but when you've got a truck that's heavy on the steers, it's a challenge. Let's go to Oklahoma. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. All I want
hey
for
there.
Christmas is a fair tax.
Oh, boy. I would, yeah. I ask for that for Christmas every year, but I never get it.
And I told you this before, but I really do want to thank you that I took your advice on audiobooks a couple of years ago, and I ran with it. It's changed my life. So.
Excellent. Love to hear that.
My question is, basically, is it possible for coolant to be in the fuel? They say the fuel, it's not my truck, they say the fuel filter is blood red. So he's saying it's coolant.
It could be. We want to look at the easy possibilities first. Do you have any coolant fuel heaters? For example, the Fast System has an option for using coolant to heat the fuel. The Fuel Pro system has an option for using coolant to heat the fuel. There are several filters on the market that allow that. And if we have one of those, that's one of the places where you could see cross-contamination. So do you know if this engine has any place where they use coolant to heat the fuel?
I've seen the truck, and I don't believe it does. The reason why I was asking is because my answer was that's not possible, because I thought I'd heard before calls before saying they thought there was coolant in there. Fuel because of injectors, and that's what they're telling him.
Not injectors, but injector cups. So there is a difference. The injector itself, the tip of the injector is in the combustion chamber. There is no way for that fuel coming out of the injector tip to make it into the cooling system. Well, there is a way, but we'd be talking about a major catastrophe. We would be talking about holes in the liners. So it is possible,
right.
But if it happens, the engine is shot, the block, everything.
He's pretty rare.
He's
been in the shop for a week, you know, and that's just, I don't trust shops and stuff, but I just thought it was pretty insane that he's still in the shop.
Yeah, now it could be injector cups, because the injector cup, on one side of the cup is fuel, and on the other side of the injector cup is coolant. And injector cups can get holes in them. Now, most of the time, because of the way the pressure works, most of the time, if you get a hole in an injector cup, you are going to get fuel in the coolant. But it is possible, depending on where the hole is, that it happens the other way, that we get coolant in the fuel. It's just a little more rare. But it could happen. But there are a couple other ways. Like I said, you could look at the Fuel Pro filter and not realize that it's heated by the coolant. Now, if you look real close and you track lines back, you can figure it out. But that's fairly common to have some cross-contamination because of a heated fuel system.
Well, I'll just ask him if he has a heater system then. Maybe that's where it's coming from. So, and one more thing. If you're ever in Coffeyville, Kansas, you'll have a place to park your rig and a free dinner. I mean it.
Well, perfect. Perfect.
Yeah. So I appreciate everything you do.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that, and appreciate the offer. And have a Merry Christmas. Let's go to California. Les, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I too want to thank you for all your help. You're just a plethora of
You're welcome.
For a more mature, balanced life. I've been at your suggestion, listen to Tony Robbins' audio, Money Master of the Game, and I'm thinking about the IRA and a Roth. What are your thoughts?
Okay. I have some pretty strong opinions about this. Retirement investing, I think, is crucial. And let's just talk about, in general, why we would not just save money or invest money, why we would do a big part of our investment in retirement accounts, no matter what kind they are. And that's because there is potential tax savings, and that tax savings may allow our money to grow faster. So anytime we can keep money away from the IRS, we want to do that. Now,
yes,
the
sir.
Challenge becomes, do we want the tax break now, or do we want the tax break in retirement? And if it were an even proposition, meaning we can save X amount of dollars now and the same amount later, well, then I would always say, let's save it now. But
yep,
that's not
naturally.
The case. Here, let me give you the easiest example I can. And these numbers aren't going to mean anything. They just help me illustrate the math. Let's say you put $1,000 in a traditional IRA right now. When you do it, you get to deduct that $1,000 off of your personal income before you pay tax. So it will roughly save you about $150.
Yes.
Now, and it will save you that today, right now, when you pay your taxes. Now, let's say that $1,000, you don't add anything more to it, over the years between now and when you retire, let's say that $1,000 turns into $10,000. And you decide on the day of retirement, you want to take it all out. Now, this is a traditional IRA. You already had your tax savings. You saved $150. And every year as it was growing, you weren't paying any tax on the growth. But when you take that $10,000 out, you pay tax on all of it. So now you're going to pay $1,500. Yeah, you're going to pay $1,500 in tax. You saved $150 at the beginning. You're going to pay $1,500 now. Now, let's compare that with putting it into a Roth IRA. You put $1,000 into the Roth today, you get no tax savings. You're going to have to pay tax on all the money that came in. You get no tax break. Now, that sounds bad. But as the money starts growing every year, you're not going to pay any tax on the growth. We get to retirement day. You have the same $10,000 because the type of account doesn't change the investment. So you still end up with $10,000, but when you take the $10,000 out, you don't have to pay any tax.
Oh, clearly that's the way to go.
Yeah, so you paid your $150 in the beginning instead of saving it, but now we don't have to pay the $1,500. We don't have to pay anything.
Yeah, correct. It seems like Congress's habit is the taxes go up, not down, and you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years is going to be a lot higher than it is today. All right, well, thank you.